Kia ora te whānau, we're working here. How's that? Awesome. Ah, kia ora te whānau, morena. Great to be a part of the service, and thank you for leading us the way you have, Claire and Catherine this morning, and all that army of people who have been tautukuing your mahi, your work. So thank you. It's great to be able to sit in a space that has kind of been gathered in this way where there's more inner quiet for, at least for me. I like it. As was indicated earlier, we're drawing this series of the end of them and us together today. Not that the ongoing learning that hopefully we have been downloading in the context of these weeks will cease, the learning that there is for us. And today, I just wanted to reflect on a text which explores the relationship that we have with religious and cultural outsiders, or people whose experience of faith and spirituality and religion and whose cultural settings are different from our own. And the passage that we're going to be looking at is in Luke chapter 9, 46 to 55, if you've got a Bible on your phone, or you've got another Bible there, then feel free to keep it open as we just reflect on this text today. In coming to the text, I was reminded of some of my growing years here in Otatahi Christchurch, and I spent the first 6 years of my life in Mottram Street in Redwood. And when I got to school age, primary school age, I used to walk down Daniels Road and then down the North Road to St. Joseph's Primary School. And sometimes when we were going to primary school, the Catholic kids going to St. Joseph's would kind of stick together, and the kids going to the public school around the corner in Cranford Street would also keep together. And on some occasions, they exchanged greetings with one another, and the greetings kind of went like this. Catholic dogs stink like hogs in their mother's bathing togs. And we would reciprocate by saying, public dogs stink like hogs in their mother's bathing togs. Now, where this, you know, kind of harmonious neighbourhood practice came from, I have no idea. But it was just kind of a bit of a thing. Now, I'm sure that Middleton Grange High School students on their way past Rickerton students don't say anything like that these days, or even think anything untoward towards those from another educational institute. But it was kind of a weird thing, and clearly many of us had kind of imbibed these religious prejudices and, you know, and biases that had their roots way back, probably into the Irish experience and Catholicism in Ireland and so on. But there was still some feeling that carried over between Protestants and Catholics in New Zealand society, even in the just a few years back when I was growing up as a lad. Now, I hope that, you know, that channeling of the deeply embedded prejudices of my parents and my parents, their generation, have changed a little, and that my perspectives and my posture and my practice has adjusted a little. I still get very grumpy with people who have religious bumper stickers like, Christians aren't perfect, they're only forgiven who cut me off on my bike. I think I'm entitled to have a little bit of rage around that. It does need to be contained from time to time. But having clocked up a little bit more life experience, there have been some shifts on the graphs in my life, but not as good as I would like them to be. And the passage this morning is one which challenges that part of me that received that kind of training, as it were, albeit unwittingly, in bias and prejudice. And it's found, as I said, in Luke chapter 9. And in the passage, we read that an argument arises amongst the disciples about who is the greatest. The disciples, you know, are concerned about who's the top of the food chain, who's the goat. I understand in tennis now that unquestionably Novak Djokovic is the GOAT in terms of the male tennis player because he has won more opens than anyone else and various other awards. So statistically, it's confirmed he is the GOAT. Someone may want to argue about that afterwards, who you tennis fans, but people do this in sport, don't they? Who's the most important? Who's the most accomplished? Who's the most powerful? And then we have all kinds of other competitions going on in life around us, some of them subconsciously within ourselves and also with other people. Who's superior? Who's supreme? Who's the most intelligent, the most beautiful, the most wealthy, the most popular, the most liked, the most spiritual even? And groups, there's a kind of a group thing that goes on with us too, where Christian churches often kind of are comparing themselves to one another. C.S. Lewis talks about pride as this thing is always born out of comparison. When you stop comparing, there's no place for pride. But there is this comparing goes on, and it was clearly present amongst the disciples. And of course, when you're concerned about greatness, your preoccupation becomes with how do you get to whatever you have established as the greatest state or the greatest point. And people and resources become a means towards that end. They are things to use or things to step on or to step over in your journey towards that great place or that great state. They are there to serve you. They're there to help you get ahead. They assist you to achieve your greatness. And of course, when that happens, our perspective towards others, our relational posture is they become competitors or they become opponents or even worse, they become enemies. And the disciples were kind of in this discussion potentially setting themselves up for this kind of relational breakdown. You contest, you oppose, you fight, you overcome, you win. And what we know now about colonization and mission, for instance, is that was born out of a belief that Britain and the British were superior to the tangata whenua, to the people of this land, to the First Nations people who lived here and continue to live here. And some Christian mission was also born out of the idea that Christian people, along with their Christian faith, were superior to the indigenous people of this land, to tangata whenua. And all over the world, this experiment in colonization was born out of this sense of superiority and this projection of inferiority onto others. We're better than them, we're above them, and they need to become like us. It's an insidious pattern that finds its way into our lives. Or how does Jesus respond to the disciples when he comes across, overhears, observes this conversation about greatness going on? Well, the passage tells us this. It says, Jesus, aware of their inner thoughts, took a little child, put the child by his side and said to them, whoever welcomes this child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. For the least amongst all of you is the greatest. So Jesus turns the notion of greatness on its head. He brings a child into the group and he stands close to that child. And he uses this language of welcome. Why a child? Well, in terms of even the scene that's taking place, clearly the disciples with their preoccupation around who was going to be the greatest, completely overlooked the presence of the child in the midst of this company of the people that had gathered with them and with Jesus. And children are often literally overlooked or pushed to the margins. And in some societies, they're deemed as being less significant than the adults in the room. children, the old, you know, proverb that children should be seen and not heard should leave most of us gasping today. But there's a kind of sense in our behavior that's often the message that children receive. And Jesus says that when you welcome, embrace, and receive this child, whom you overlook and dismiss, you receive me, and in actual fact, you receive God in receiving this little overlooked one, this one pushed to the margins, this one who has deemed as having nothing of value to add to your conversation about what constitutes greatness and who is the greatest. In thinking about this response of Jesus, I've been thinking that he seems to be pointing out to the disciples that greatness isn't something we obtain by virtue of our position in a society or by virtue of our performance. Greatness is something that is intrinsic to all human identity because of the indwelling presence of God in all. I mean, that just blows my conservative, Catholic, and evangelical kind of trains of thought out the window. What if that's what Jesus is seeking to communicate here? Greatness isn't something that all have to obtain or reach to. Greatness is something which every single human being already contains or has. And by virtue of that, we all have something to contribute and we all have something to learn from one another. And when we embrace the people who are most marginalized, we are most in harmony with the heart of God who embraces all, whose heart is particularly for those who are pushed further out and off the edges, whoever they may be. We need to pay particular attention to the greatness that is in those who we see as the least. And Jesus is saying, listen up, open your eyes, receive what they have to offer you. I love that when we're talking about mission here and mission among the poor, there's not a posture of we've got a big basket of things that we're going to carry over and offer to them and won't they be better? The image of mission, I think I've spoken briefly about it before, which was offered to us some time ago as part of the Southwest community. By one of our Māori kaumātua was the image of two kete, baskets, and having one basket on our back and one in our front. And the one in the front is empty because it's there to receive everything that the other has to offer. And the one in the back, yes, does carry things that we can sensitively and judiciously take out to offer the other when it's appropriate. But the fundamental posture with the basket on the front is being ready to receive all that the other has to offer. And this is part of what Jesus is seeking to bring home in this place here. Some years ago, I watched the movie Neverland. It's a fictional story, but based on the life of the Scottish playwright and novelist James Barrie, who wrote Peter Pan. And there's this lovely scene in the movie where it's opening night. It's the premiere of the production, and that the kind of the noise in the community has been, this is going to be a complete flop. It's going to be a failure. The upper class British theatre going audience are just going to see this as trivial and trite, and they won't be interested in it. And some, you know, the punters arrive and they're all dressed in their suits and their theatre-going clothing, and then there's a group of little orphans come marching down the street, and James Barrie has asked them to come into the theatre, and they come into the theatre and make their way into the rows, and they make their way past these adults who actually, you can see by the expressions on the faces, are recoiling from these orphans. They look at them in dismissive ways, and they look at them, some of them even have a look of contempt and disgust. What are these orphans doing in our space, in our theatre, coming to our production? And the kids, they wriggle in and they take seats. And the curtain rises and the play begins. and something funny happens, the adults are just staunch heirs, which is kind of sitting here. They have a predetermined notion about this, that it's not going to be good, that it's not entertaining, it's not of value. The kids are sitting there, and they're just spontaneously reacting to what they see. Some of them grin, some of them laugh, some of them move forward in their seats. And slowly, the adults allow themselves the luxury of a response themselves. One allows himself a little grin. Then one kind of does a little shoulder shrug chuckle. And the energy of the children spreads through the theater. And before long, the adults are caught up in the story themselves and enjoying it because the gift of the children's presence in their midst made them alive to what they could not see. Jesus here knows something about how people whom we dismiss as having nothing to offer are able to awaken things in us, that God part of us, that desperately need awakening. So when he goes on in this passage, and Luke has these three little scenes, and this is the first one, he moves to the next one. And he moves from children to another situation where John comes and says to him, "Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name and we tried to stop him because he doesn't follow with us." Very closely related to what's already happened. Whereas in that first little scene, the disciples' perception of who's important and what is great and what must be done with power is desperately twisted, and Jesus needs to adjust the settings. Here, now it's the notion of how wide is the circle of God's love. So John, who we understand from one of the other Gospels, Jesus along had named as one of the sons of thunder. He didn't drive a big V8 car. But he and his brother James clearly would seem from that nickname had some issues with their temper, had some pressure points, the triggers that were easy to push, perhaps speculative, but certainly here it becomes evident, and in the next scene. So what does this do? This reflects this them and us mindset that John and the other disciples have. We are the ones who are close to Jesus, to you, Jesus. We follow with you. We have the close relationship. We know your mind, your words, and your heart. We're the ones who are best placed to understand your mind and pursue your mission in the world. And we're the ones who've had the best experience of your training and teaching. This other person doesn't belong to our group. He isn't part of our community. He hasn't been taught and trained like we have. He doesn't know what we know. Yeah, sure, he was helping somebody who had destructive forces at work within their life and bringing them into a state of greater wellness and wholeness. Let's just kind of frame that deliverance up in that way. And yes, he was doing it in your name and the spirit and manner that you've demonstrated and taught us. But yes, he was showing compassion, sharing love, but he's not part of our group. He's not one of us. So we tried to stop him. We tried to shut him down and shut him up. I mean, I find the world of the internet in this regard, it's the most frightening place. Any Christian who pops their head up with their own blog or website and maybe offers a belief or an approach to faith that's slightly different will immediately attract a swarm of people criticizing them, sometimes in the most abjectly demeaning and dehumanizing way. The arbiters of truth, the heretic hunters, they're all over the place online. People doing amazing things with compassionate heart, getting shot down by people who say, "But you're not part of the group that's closest to God." And when that kind of attitude finds its way into church life and individuals' lives and groups and denominations and religious organizations, it's the death of love. It's the death of love. And Jesus sees it here. He says to him, don't stop him. Whoever's not against you is for you. Why the hell are you shutting him down? For goodness sake. Can't you see the love and the compassion and the good that's coming from this work? He's not your opponent. He's your teammate, for goodness sake. You know, having grown up in that narrow little Catholic world, one of the experiences that helped me to open up my bigoted little self was going to Bible college and meeting Pentecostals and Brethren and Presbyterians and others. Sure, it was still within the circle of the Christian faith, but I'd grown up frightened of these people, thinking they didn't believe in God the way they should, and they didn't practice faith the way they should, and they were probably going to hell. You know, so that experience even of stepping into a new world and adopting the posture of a learner helped to start opening my heart, my crippled little narrow, bigoted heart a little bit more. And Jesus wants to do that to his disciples here as well. The disciples were othering and opposing and excluding, and Jesus was affirming and supporting and including. The disciples were building walls. Jesus walked straight through the places that they had erected walls and didn't even seem to see them. He wasn't breaking down walls. He was just walking straight through them. He seemed to do that later on, didn't he? Final little scene here, just quickly, is where Jesus embraces somebody who's a cultural and religious outsider. Not somebody who's part of the group, potentially, but somebody who's definitely not in the group and definitely culturally and religiously removed. It says, when the days drew near for Jesus to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem, and he sent messengers ahead of them. On their way, they entered the village of the Samaritans to prepare for his arrival, but they didn't receive him because his face was set toward Jerusalem. And when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to nuke them? Do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? So here, this group of disciples, again, who are finding it such a struggle to understand what Jesus is on about. I love the way three times in these little scenes, you get, but Jesus. But disciples want to do this, but Jesus. The disciples want to do this, but Jesus. And he's turning them around. He's turning to point them in a different direction. It's the pathway of self-sacrificial love that will bring him ultimately to the cross in Jerusalem. And the disciples are walking some other path that doesn't look anything like that, and he's trying to pull them back onto it. They go looking for some accommodation, the hospitality, the manaakitanga, and they get the cultural equivalent of a one-fingered salute from these Samaritan villagers. Because the history of these peoples was one, much like in places around the world today, Palestine, Serbia, Croatia, Ireland, Belfast, a little bit of that slipping over into my childhood, where the animosity and the hostility, the intergenerational animosity and hostility and hatred towards people of other ethnicities and other cultural groups and other religions had been set deeply into people's lives. You can read about the history of the Samaritans in 2 Kings 17, 24 to 41. Just suffice to say that these were Jewish people who had intermarried with people who had been brought into the land after the Assyrians conquered it in about 21 BC. So for hundreds of years, there had been animosity. When the Jews came back into the land, the Samaritans had opposed the rebuilding of the temple. And the people who came back viewed themselves as the purists, and they viewed the Samaritans as tainted, and they had developed some of their own approach to the sacred text. They only held to the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, and they set up a temple for themselves on a different mountain. And so there was this cultural and religious animosity. So much so that many Jews, especially religious leaders, wouldn't even travel through that area of northern Samaria. They would go and they would take a route that went up along the Jordan River and come back in further up near Galilee to avoid any contact with these people. There was far-reaching, long-standing hatred and animosity between these people. And it says, when James and John saw this, they said, "Do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them?" Jesus turned to them and says, "You don't know what manner of spirit you are." This is in an alternative text. "You do not know what spirit you're of, for the Son of Man did not come to destroy the lives of humans, but to save them." So this is the third time in this little group of passages that Jesus has to correct the disciples. He rebukes them. He tells them out of tune with his heart and his way, their perspective, their posture, and their proposed practice is taking them in a completely different direction from Jesus. He hasn't come to create some new category of insider and outsider. He hasn't come to develop some new form of exclusivism and tribalism. He hasn't come to perpetuate religious and spiritual hatred, hostility, and harm. He hasn't come to extract vengeance and retribution on people who don't worship God in the way that the in-group insists. He's come with a new understanding of those sacred texts. He's come to demonstrate the love of God for all cultures and religions and to rescue and restore the broken lives of all. And Jesus just throws their world upside down. I was reading a book recently by Barbara Brown Taylor called Holy Envy, Finding Faith in the Faith of Others. And she talks about a class that she runs for tertiary students, graduate students, who looking at from within a Christian tertiary teaching institution, but looking at relationship with people of other faiths. And she takes them on all these experiences into Sikh temples, into Muslim mosques, Hindu temples and Muslim mosques, and into Jewish synagogues, and they sit with people in those places and they eat with them and they learn all kinds of things about who these people are. And she talks about holy envy, the discovery that many of these students have who formerly were opposed and hostile. Some of them wanting to call down fire have been taught that maybe that was the thing to do. These are people who sit under the judgment of a God who really only favors them. Discovering that there are many beautiful things woven into the lives of these people they then became envious of. They have so much to teach us. So here the disciples stand apart from the people, and Jesus calls them to stand with them. His way is radically different. Let me just summarize the things that have occurred to me here. So the disciples are preoccupied with climbing the ladder of greatness, making Israel great again. But Jesus is preoccupied with descending the ladder of service, helping people become well and flourish, using the love and life of God within to nurture that in the other. The disciples want to use power to gratify themselves, but Jesus wants to use the power he has to embrace and empower the least. The disciples are shutting people out. Jesus is gathering people in. The disciples are othering, opposing, and excluding. And Jesus is affirming, supporting, and including. The disciples are channeling hatred, hostility, and harm And Jesus is channeling love, grace, and mercy. We make the road by walking, is the title of another book. And this is the kind of thing that's going on here. Jesus is saying there's another road to make. If you follow me on my path to Jerusalem, the path of self-sacrificial love, the footsteps that you leave behind will be footsteps that are marked with the same love. And that's the invitation to us, or one of them, in this mission week that we have. We're going to have Barstool. Chance for people just to respond now with whatever it is that's been stirred in you or sitting in you from our time together and your time during the week.